Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine a 19-year-old college dropout, really charismatic, seems brilliant, and she convinces some of the world's most powerful people that she holds the future of medicine right in her hands. The only problem, it was built on a foundation of monumental lies.
Yeah.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into that captivating, but also deeply cautionary tale of Elizabeth Holmes and her company Theranos.
Right.
We're drawing heavily from John Carey's amazing book, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup.
A phenomenal read.
Absolutely. And our mission here is to really extract the crucial insights from this. Well, it's basically a corporate thriller. We want to understand exactly how this audacious deception unfolded.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe most importantly, uncover the profound lessons it holds for all of us, you know, about ambition, trust, and the relentless pursuit of truth.
You know, what's so striking about Bad Blood is that it's way more than just the story of a failed company. It's really like a definitive autopsy of one of the biggest corporate frauds we've seen since Enron.
That's a big statement.
It is. It's a modern tragedy, really. It forces us to interrogate the very nature of innovation, deception, and maybe even our own human capacity for self-delusion.
Mm.
And we'll definitely connect this incredible story to the broader Silicon Valley culture and explore why its lessons are still incredibly relevant for you, our listener, today.
Okay, so let's really start at the beginning then. Let's trace Elizabeth Holmes's ascent, the building of her vision, and the careful crafting of her myth.
Right.
She wasn't exactly born into obscurity, was she? Raised in D.C., then Houston.
Mm-hmm.
Her family had this background of kind of influence and ambition.
Yeah, deep lineage there.
And that clearly instilled in her this profound sense of destiny from a really young age.
Mm-hmm.
The book shares this pretty surprising detail from her childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, at just 9 years old, she wrote a letter to her father.
Get this.
Declaring her life's goal was, quote, to discover something new, something that mankind didn't know was possible to do.
Wow. At nine.
9 years old. Talk about early ambition. And then later, she very consciously seemed to adopt Steve Jobs as her blueprint. Right.
Oh, now. Absolutely. From the persona, the black turtlenecks.
Right. The turtlenecks.
To that powerful narrative of the college dropout who's going to change the world. It was very deliberate.
So Stanford was part of that plan then?
Her brief time at Stanford University, yeah, it really acted as a pivotal launch pad for that ambition.
Mm-hmm.
She enrolled in 2002, chemical engineering,
mm-hmm.
a field that, you know, at the time seemed ripe for disruption, especially in biotech.
Okay.
Her decision to drop out at 19 in 2003, using her tuition money to found Real-Time Cures, which, you know, later became Theranos.
Right.
That was a perfectly calculated step into that whole visionary dropout mythos that Silicon Valley loves.
And she got a professor on board early.
Critically, yes. Her chemical engineering professor, Channing Robertson, became her very first board member.
Oh.
And that lent, immense credibility to this fledgling startup. A truly crucial early enabler, even if perhaps his specific expertise wasn't directly in diagnostic blood testing.
Interesting. And what a trajectory it was after that. For what, over a decade, Theranos operated in what she famously called stealth mode.
Mm-hmm. In secret, pretty much.
Her pitch was it was almost irresistible, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Imagine cheap, painless, instantaneous blood tests.
All from a finger prick.
All from a tiny finger prick,
yeah.
Promising to democratize healthcare.
It's a powerful vision.
Totally. And she meticulously crafted her public image. The signature black turtleneck, we mentioned that.
Yep.
A famously deepened voice.
Right, the voice change.
And this grand aspirational rhetoric that always, always revolved around changing the world.
And it worked. She didn't just attract initial investors. She amassed this like pantheon of powerful older men on her board.
Yeah, the board was incredible.
We're talking former secretaries of state like George Shultz and Henry Kissinger.
Wow.
William Perry, James Mattis. I mean, these men were just captivated by her poise, her vision.
They basically provided this unimpeachable stamp of approval, right?
Exactly. And with that kind of backing, you had major investors like Rupert Murdoch, Larry Ellison, Tim Draper. They poured in hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions.
Pushing Theranos' valuation to, well, a staggering $9
billion. And $9 billion, making Holmes, at least on paper.
On paper, yeah.
The world's youngest self-made female billionaire.
So I flee.
Yeah.
But, you know, what many people maybe didn't realize then is that their real triumphs, they weren't happening in the lab. that were happening in the boardroom, those landmark partnerships, like with Walgreens in 2013 and that massive deal with Safeway, those were huge commercial breakthroughs.
Okay, so the business deals were real.
The deals were real. Okay. They gave Theranos this crucial air of consumer legitimacy, you know, poised to bring their revolutionary services directly to the public. But behind those closed doors, the book reveals it was just this chaotic scramble of scientific failure, faked demonstrations.
Faked demos.
Oh, yeah. And a corporate culture just steeped in paranoia and intimidation. And this whole charade was pretty much orchestrated by Holmes and her partner, the company president, Sunny Balwani.
Right, Balwani.
So the external perception was total triumph, while the internal reality was, well, it was crumbling.
So, okay, we've built up this image of a visionary, this incredible success story on the surface. But the book points to something it calls the original sin back in 2006 with Novartis. What exactly happened there?
Yeah.
Why was that such a pivotal moment?
That moment was just critical because it wasn't simply a prototype failing, which happens, right?
Sure, happens all the time in tech.
It was the active choice to falsify the results. When their device, their prototype, repeatedly failed during these crucial demos for the Swiss pharmaceutical giant Novartis, Holmes reportedly instructed her team to just use pre-recorded successful data instead.
Wow. Instead of admitting the failure.
Exactly. Instead of going back to the drawing board, fixing the problem. This established a really dangerous precedent. When reality failed, they didn't fix it. They faked it.
So it set a pattern.
It absolutely set a pattern of continuous deception. Yeah.
So it wasn't just a one-off mistake under pressure. That single decision basically set the stage for how they'd handle every future challenge.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And that precedent had profound consequences, especially, you know, when they started to scale up.
Like with the Walgreens and Safeway deal?
Exactly. Those deals were truly the point of no return. They created this immense pressure for Theranos to deliver a product that was, well, it was nowhere near ready.
Right.
So to try and meet these huge commercial demands, Theranos began secretly running the vast majority of tests on commercially available third-party machines. Stuff from Siemens, for example.
Wait, so they weren't using their own revolutionary machines?
For most tests, no. But the problem wasn't just using external tech. Lots of labs do that. The problem was trying to adapt their tiny finger prick samples.
Mm-hmm.
The thing they promised was revolutionary for machines that were designed for much larger traditional venous blood draws.
Ah, I see. Different sample types.
Completely different.
Yeah.
So this often meant they had to dilute those tiny finger prick samples.
Which would affect the results.
Absolutely. It fundamentally compromised the accuracy of vital diagnostic tests.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about tests people rely on for their health. It put real patients at real risk.
That's terrifying. And speaking of brazen acts of deception, the book details this Potemkin lab that they apparently created for Joe Biden's visit in 2015. Can you walk us through that?
Oh, that story is just, it's a stunning example of the lengths they would go to.
Right.
So then Vice President Joe Biden was scheduled to tour their facility. A huge deal, obviously.
It's a huge PR opportunity.
Massive. But their actual labs were chaotic. The tech wasn't working properly. So Theranos created a fake staged lab.
Like a movie set.
Essentially, yeah. They built this facade of a functioning, legitimate, cutting-edge lab, completely hiding the true chaotic and non-functional state of their actual technology.
Wow.
It was just stunningly brazen. Deceiving one of the most powerful men in the world about the core operational capabilities of their product.
Unbelievable. And, you know, if you want a metaphor for the whole situation, one of the most bizarre stories in the book, but one that perfectly illustrates this kind of shared delusion, is the anecdote about Holmes' dog, Balto.
Ah, yes. Balto the wolf.
The wolf dog. Can you tell us about that? What does it reveal about the culture inside Theranos?
That story is pure gold, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Holmes gets this Siberian husky, a beautiful dog, but definitely a husky.
Okay.
But she insisted to everyone, despite all evidence, that he was a wolf.
A wolf roaming the office.
Exactly. She allowed him to just roam the office, even the sensitive lab areas.
Oh, my goodness.
And the dog, predictably, was not house trained, so he frequently had accidents.
In the lab.
In the office. Maybe labs, too. I don't recall exactly, but assistants would then have to clean it up.
Oh, wow.
But it's Theranos in a nutshell, right? Holmes presented something as one thing, this revolutionary wolf, when it was actually something else entirely, just a normal dog making a mess.
And everyone had to pretend it was a wolf.
And she created this environment where everyone was forced to go along with this absurd fiction, no matter how much it flew in the face of, you know, basic reality.
That's, yeah, that's a powerful illustration. And it makes you wonder, how did this kind of systemic deception, this specific weird culture, how did it manage to continue for so long?
Well, the book paints a picture of a profoundly toxic culture within Theranos.
Toxic how?
Adversity, whether it was, you know, legitimate scientific problems or even just skeptical questions from employees, it was met with intense paranoia and aggression.
So you couldn't question things?
Not safely, no. Employees who dared to raise concerns were systematically marginalized, ostracized, and very often fired.
Mm-hmm.
And the company's legal department, led by the very formidable David Boies,
famous lawyer.
Very famous, very high-powered. They used truly scorched-earth tactics.
Yeah.
Legal threats, surveillance, outright intimidation. Anything to silence whistleblowers and anyone who threatened that carefully constructed narrative.
That sounds absolutely terrifying. And it brings us, sadly, to one of the most tragic human costs in this whole saga. The story of the British scientist Ian Gibbons.
You know, when you read that part in Carrie Rue's book, it's truly chilling.
Yeah.
Ian Gibbons was a brilliant biochemist. He'd been working in this field for decades, and he knew unequivocally that Holmes's claims were scientifically impossible with their current technology. He knew the tech wasn't working.
He knew the truth.
He knew the truth. And he was under immense pressure from the company, caught up in patent lawsuits, fearing he might be forced to perjure himself or face professional ruin from Theranos' aggressive legal team.
Oh, no.
He took his own life the night before he was scheduled for a deposition in 2013.
That's heartbreaking. It's devastating. And his death was just this awful indictment of the toxic, fear-ridden environment Holmes and Balwani created. It really elevates this beyond just corporate fraud to a genuine human tragedy. It shows the dark power of fear in an unchecked environment.
Wow. So the full extent of this elaborate deception, it finally started to unravel. But not from within, right? It came from external scrutiny.
That's right. The beginning of the end really came not from a regulator, not from an investor discovering the truth, but from a skeptical journalist.
John Carreyrou.
John Carreyrou of the Wall Street Journal.
And he wasn't working in a vacuum, right? There were whistleblowers.
Absolutely. And the courage of the individuals who spoke up, you really cannot overstate it. Tyler Schultz?
Dort Schultz's grandson.
Exactly. Grandson of board member George Schultz. He was a key whistleblower. After witnessing just blatant scientific misconduct inside Theranos, things like doctored quality control data,
he became a confidential source for Carreyrou. He risked his entire career, his reputation, and faced immense personal conflict because his own grandfather initially sided with Holmes against him.
That must have been incredibly difficult.
Unimaginably so. And Erica Chun, another brave young employee, also came forward to expose the truth, despite facing significant personal and legal threats.
It's incredible to think that despite Holmes and Balwani's really aggressive legal campaign against Carreyrou, and the book details even a personal appeal from Holmes herself to the WSJ's owner, Rupert Murdoch.
Who's an investor.
Who is a major investor. Despite all that, Carreyrou's first explosive article was published on October 15th, 2015.
Yeah.
And that really felt like the moment the world's perception of Theranos just shattered.
Precisely. That article, which was just meticulously sourced, it utterly dismantled the Theranos myth. It revealed the core deceptions, the failing technology, the secret use of those third-party machines.
The house of cards came down.
Pretty much. And it triggered this rapid cascade of events. Regulatory agencies, like the CMS, soon confirmed Carreyrou's reporting. They uncovered widespread failures, serious safety violations.
Okay.
Walgreens quickly terminated its partnership. Regulators banned Holmes from operating a lab for 2 years.
A huge blow.
Massive. And maybe most damningly, the company eventually voided 2 full years' worth of blood test results.
2 years.
2 years. Essentially admitting their data was dangerously unreliable and had potentially compromised patient health all that time.
Wow. So what became of this empire, this company that was once valued on paper at $9 billion?
Goof. It was utterly worthless.
Yeah.
In 2018, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, charged Holmes and Balwani with massive fraud.
Civil charges.
Civil, yes. But that was swiftly followed by federal criminal indictments, mm-hmm. wire fraud, conspiracy.
Okay.
The final chapter really played out in the San Jose courtroom over many months. In January 2022, Elizabeth Holmes was found guilty on 4 counts of defrauding investors.
And the sentence?
She was sentenced to over 11 years in federal prison. She's serving that time now.
And the Balwani.
Sonny Balwani, in a separate trial, was found guilty on all counts against him and received a sentence of nearly 13 years.
So prison time for both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The story that began with this, you know, visionary dropout's dream, it ended with a convicted felon's prison sentence.
It's such a stark conclusion, and it really prompts us to examine her core philosophy, her motivations. I mean, on the surface, it was always about democratizing healthcare, right? That was the pitch.
That was the noble pitch, yes.
But what did Bad Blood reveal about the deeper drivers? What was really going on underneath?
The book really pulls back the curtain on what seems like a deeply Machiavellian worldview at play.
Yeah.
You know, the classic ends justify the means.
Right.
Holmes seemed to inhabit what's often called a reality distortion field, a term, you know, famously associated with Steve Jobs, where her grand aspirational goals were consistently presented as current, tangible realities. And this made it incredibly difficult for anyone inside the bubble to really challenge the narrative.
Because questioning the goal felt like questioning the reality she projected.
Exactly. And her deepest motivation. It seems it wasn't solely about money, though that was obviously part of it. It appears to have been this all-consuming ambition to be historic, to be the next Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, coupled with what the book portrays as a pathological need for control, control over the narrative, control over her employees, and frankly, control over reality itself.
And how did that philosophy, that need for control, dictate her approach when things inevitably went wrong, when she faced adversity?
Well, she seemed to treat every obstacle, every setback, not as a problem to be solved, but as a threat to be neutralized.
Okay.
So when the technology failed, they didn't pivot or fundamentally fix it, they faked the results.
Right.
When employees raised legitimate concerns, they weren't listened to. They were met with paranoia, aggression, fired, or silenced with legal threats.
Yeah.
This created this suffocating echo chamber where the founding lie that the technology worked could just grow and grow unchallenged until it reached catastrophic proportions.
And ultimately, the biggest obstacle wasn't a competitor or a regulator.
Ultimately, the single greatest obstacle Theranos faced was just reality itself. The fundamental laws of chemistry and physics proved stubbornly resistant to Holmes's vision and willpower. The technology simply did not work as promised. And that fundamental failure, that was truly the original sin from which all the subsequent lies and deceptions inevitably flowed.
So looking back now professionally, Theranos is, I mean, it's literally a Harvard Business School case study in what not to do, right?
Oh, absolutely. Required reading in ethics classes now, I imagine.
It's become this brutal reminder for investors about the absolute necessity of rigorous due diligence, actually kicking the tires, not just believing the hype. A reminder for boards about their fundamental duty of oversight, not just being cheerleaders.
A huge lesson there for board members.
And maybe for the media, too, about its susceptibility to well-crafted, charismatic narratives, especially in Silicon Valley.
Definitely. And culturally, the Theranos saga has left this deep scar on Silicon Valley. It really exposed the dark underbelly of that whole disruptive innovation and fake it till you make it ethos.
Right.
Which had maybe gone largely unchecked for too long.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Holmes, who was once hailed as this feminist icon, a breakthrough female founder.
Yeah, she was on magazine covers everywhere.
Everywhere. She became cultural shorthand for deception. And her signature black turtleneck, once this homage to Jobsian genius, is now just irrevocably linked to her fraud.
It's tainted now.
Completely. And beyond the headlines, the human legacy is one of tragedy and courage, isn't it?
Yeah.
You have the potential harm to patients from those inaccurate tests.
Which is still hard to quantify.
Very hard. You have the traumatized employees, the suicide of Ian Gibbons we discussed, and importantly, the incredible bravery of the whistleblowers like Tyler Schultz and Erica Chung, who risked so much to bring the truth out.
So for you listening today, the question really becomes, what can we truly learn from all of this? What are the takeaways beyond the, you know, the sensational headlines?
Well, I think firstly, it's a stark reminder that a compelling story, no matter how inspiring it sounds, can be a dangerous thing if it's not grounded in actual truth. Holmes's narrative resonated because it promised this utopian vision of healthcare. But that powerful story often overshadowed the need for critical scientific scrutiny. So always question the narrative, especially when it seems too good to be true.
Okay, that's one.
Secondly, the slippery slope of small lies is just vividly illustrated here, isn't it? Those seemingly minor deceptions early on, like faking that Novartis demo.
Yeah.
They compounded over time into this catastrophic fraud that impacted real lives, real health outcomes. It shows how easily small compromises can escalate.
Right. And third.
And thirdly, I think, the immense courage required to speak truth to power. What Tyler Schultz and Erica Chung did. It's a powerful testament to individual integrity. even when facing immense personal and professional pressure. It shows that individuals can make a difference.
Absolutely. And maybe on a more practical level, especially if you're involved in business or maybe investments.
Yeah, a few things jump out. Due diligence is simply non-negotiable. It's your absolute first line of defense against hype and fraud. Don't outsource your skepticism.
Okay.
And culture truly is everything. Theranos's toxic, fear-based culture actively prevented problems from being surfaced and solved. It allowed the deception to fester. A healthy culture encourages dissent.
Right. That makes sense.
And maybe, yeah, beware the imperial CEO, the founder, with seemingly unchecked power, surrounded by enablers rather than critical advisors.
Right.
That concentration of power was key here.
And it wasn't just Holmes and Balwani, was it? The enablers played a role.
Absolutely. The collective responsibility of all the enablers, from those big-name investors and board members to some in the media, it reminds us that preventing this kind of fraud requires active engagement and skepticism from everyone participating in our economic and professional systems.
So what does this all mean for us today, right now? Because we live in an era that feels defined by social media narratives, the deification of tech founders is still happening.
Oh, yeah.
We have relentless hype cycles around new technologies like AI, cryptocurrency. In that context, bad blood feels maybe more relevant than ever.
I completely agree. It serves as this incredibly timely warning.
So maybe a final thought for our listeners to mull over.
Yeah, I think this raises an important question for you to consider. The Theranos saga, at its heart, is really a timeless parable about that age-old conflict between truth and deception.
Mm.
So, as you reflect on this story, maybe ask yourself, what narratives are we choosing to believe today? In our work, in our investments, in our culture generally? Have we truly learned to look behind the curtain? Or are we perhaps still waiting, just a little bit, for the next charismatic founder with a black turtleneck to tell us what to believe?
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.